There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and as always, I'm so glad you could join us for another episode of Classic Cardboard Conversation. And my friend, we've got some classic cardboard to talk about on this program. It is not only cardboard. It is not only classic. It is another C word. Yes, colorful. As the late, great Gene Wilder would say to the late, great Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein, dim your eyes! Too late. Yes, 75 tops. The grand experiment in Technicolor in 1975. There are some reasons why tops went off the deep end with the color combinations in 1975. Yes, it's tied into the greater picture of the great game of baseball. It is tied into America and consumerism in 1975 as well. And while the 75 tops set is a classic one and it is a colorful one, it is also a royal pain in the ass to collect, as I am finding out. And I will share some stories as to why that's a royal pain in the ass to collect. It's fun. It's always fun to try to put together a set. But this is the oldest set that I've tried to hand collate. I'm still probably about 250, 300 cards short. And it is tough. And not just because of scarcity. There's actually quite a bit of 75 tops out there. It's just, as a word to the wise, if you are going to hand collate a 75 top set, I would just advise you to surrender the thought of having a set that is remotely close to, you know, very or near mint or even excellent. It is hard to find a good collection of cards from a lot of 75 tops. And there are various reasons, which we will get into. We'll also get into various biographies because this program, while I thought about talking about 75 tops for a while, we did talk 75 tops in the first run of the show. This past episode of 75 Tops would go back to, it would have been the summer of 2017, and we did one random poll. It was Vita Blue, and it was one of our most popular episodes around. But the 75 Tops set, we kind of thought about doing this look at the set again. And thanks to a rather generous donation from one of our listeners, Casey, he provided us a pack of 75 Tops that he opened, and he regrets opening, but he wanted to send it to us so that we could not only talk about the cards inside, but to also alleviate any pressure of trying to find an unopened pack of 75 tops. That is a little difficult to find, the unopened packs of 75 tops, the regular size, not just the mini set, but the regular size of 75 tops is hard to get a handle on because there is scarcity. And of course, like I said, there are some pretty big rookie cards in there. So trying to find a 75 tops pack at auction from a reliable, reputable dealer for a decent price is a little hard given our show budget. So we did our best. We were in the thick of some auctions right down to the last second and then just got outbid. But, you know, typically you're seeing some of these packs going for about $60 to $70. It's not unusual. That actually is affordable. But you know how the whole eBay auction thing works. If you're not getting that last second bid in, then you're stuck. So, you know, we weren't able to procure the unopened pack. But again, thanks to Casey, we did have a pack. And also thanks to Casey, this pack of cards not only yielded a quite nifty group of players here, but also in terms of me hand collating the set, a rare pack of cards where the cards were all centered, all crisp borders and corners. I mean, really outstanding shape. The only blemish the last card with the wax stain on it. There wasn't even a gum stain, which was kind of surprising. That's normally something that does show up in a 45-year-old pack of baseball cards. So even though there were no superstars, you will notice some recognizable names when we talk about them. But even though there were no superstars, it was a great donation here. And Casey also just throwing in for my own personal collection an unopened pack of 1977 Topps cards, which is awesome. Thank you again, Casey, for your donations. As the 77 set, which we've talked a lot about, actually. That's the other one. That's my birth year set that I'm hand collating. I'm actually a little closer to finishing that one off. But really appreciate the kind thoughts and kind words that Casey delivered, too, while we were setting up that donation. Now, getting back to that pack of cards, and I mentioned some extra biographies, there are 10 cards in a 1975 Topps wax pack. And one of the cards was one of those World Series highlights cards. And the other 9 were players. So we normally do 4 player bios when looking back at the cards that we open up. But because a 75 Topps pack is not that usual on the program, I decided to pull the bios of all 9 players here. So we're going to have all sorts of information of several former ball players. Some names that you're going to recognize, for example, like Bobby Valentine or Doug Rader, is in there as well. And some other names that you may not recognize, but some that have some certainly very interesting stories, such as John Lowenstein, Baylor Moore, also Jim Hegan. There were a few, I believe a couple of these names. In fact, Baylor Moore is the one that sticks out the most. I think we may have brought them up in previous episodes. But as I've said before, you know, we're approaching 200 episodes in the history of this program here. And when you do 200 shows and at least one bio in each show, it kind of adds up a little bit. And after a while, because I didn't take detailed notes in some of these programs, I can't really recall some of the players that we discussed, but oh well. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to look at a fun set, a frustrating set, but a unique set where it stands in the history of baseball cards, the sport of baseball, and the country. It all comes together rather nicely and rather brightly and colorfully in 1975. So we'll do that in just a few minutes. First, I want to thank our guest from our last episode, Brad Blukjan. Thank you so much for joining us. Brad, of course, the author of the Wax Pack book. And if you have not bought it yet, you need to buy it. It is an outstanding read. And I wasn't just blowing the horn for Brad's book because he was a guest on the program. Again, I really do believe it's going to be one of those books that over time becomes one of those seminal baseball card and baseball story books. It's really going to start taking its place, and I think setting a tone for a lot of baseball books moving forward, too. There have been plenty of baseball books in the past, some good, some not so good, that have tried to interweave life stories along with baseball stories, but this one's a little different. Tracking down former baseball players while Brad also tracks down some of his past ghosts, find some common storylines and some pretty entertaining stories, too. It's all together in the Wax Pack book. So make sure you check that out if you haven't already. And also check out the website that Brad mentioned, PBB.com. That is PBBClub.com. So PBBClub.com, that is PandemicBaseballBookClub.com. Brad, along with several other authors, kind of caught up in the whole coronavirus thing too. They weren't able to go across the nation or around the world to promote the book. And because of the coronavirus, they basically had to resort only to online marketing and promotion, which is not a bad thing in the 21st century, but obviously any way you can promote a book that you've spent years putting together, you always want to do that. And of course, they had their options limited and continue to do so. So check out the works at pbbclub.com, the Pandemic Baseball Book Club, where not only Brad Blukjan, but other baseball authors have their books for sale. And of course, every purchase helps the authors, including Brad, continue to work on some other exciting future projects. So again, Brad Blukjan, awesome. Thanks again for joining us. And again, I'm very happy and proud of the success of the Wax Pack book, something that he and I discussed back in September of 2016. It seemed so close, but almost 4 years later, he was finally able to get that book out there. So that is awesome. Speaking of the pandemic, again, wear your mask, wash your hands, practice social distancing. It's amazing, you know, when science and facts are able to cut through the noise, most people finally agree and discover, hey, if you wear your mask and you wash your hands and you kind of avoid each other, it's certainly in small inside settings, you know, you tend not to get sick. So please, if not for the health and safety of others or the ones you love, if you're a selfish bastard, protect yourself. Let's just cut to the bone there. If you're just so selfish and worried about infringing my rights, well, protect your own rights by not being dead. Wear your mask, wash your hands, and practice social distancing. That is my public service announcement. And until this pandemic passes, or until we have a vaccine, or until this nation collectively pulls its head out of its arse, then we can, you know, stop making those announcements. But until any of that happens, I will continue to preach that because somebody has to. Now, we also preach our Twitter timeline with Wax and Gum Stains. It's open 24/7. Always welcome your comments, questions, suggestions. If you have show ideas, you're more than welcome to share them with us. And we've gleaned a few ideas from here. I've told you about a couple of shows that we're going to be working on in the near future. A look back at the Kmart 20th anniversary Topps MVP set, one of the most unpopular and definitely a redheaded stepchild set from the early 1980s. We'll also talk a little bit about some early to mid 90s cards. I've had some responses from people, especially asking for some Fleer and Donruss cards from like 93, 94 around there. So I'll shop around. I'm sure I can get them dirt cheap. So we'll dive into some sets from the 90s again. And I also have a desire to revisit the 1961 Topps set. For a couple of reasons. One, we originally did 61 Topps. It would have been back in 2017. Again, the first go-around of the show after we did the big monster box from 1981 to 93, we went to my binders of cards in my personal collection, and we started. At the time, we went to 1954 and moved up through 1980. Of course, since then, we've backtracked a little bit. We filled in the gaps with some sets that I was missing in the late 1940s and early 1950s. But 1961 Topps, I want to take a second look at it because my collection at the time was very small, quite literally just a handful of cards. And it has grown since then, not a whole lot. I've purchased a few cards of 61 Topps. Many of them that I have purchased are of Hall of Fame players I was just able to get great deals on, you know. And in fact, when we do the 61 Topps show, it may be Willie McCovey who is the guy that we feature, because that's one of the cards I picked up here. But I've got to look through what I've got. And, you know, since I've picked up some more notable players and the cards are in better condition than the Ted Bowersfield card that I had from back in 2017, I think it deserves a second look. And I always like doing this, and we've done it before with 1970 Topps. You know, when the Topps Heritage set came out in 2019, it was mirroring the 1970 set. And I was able to take a fresh look at it again, gained a little more appreciation for that set. Of course, 88 Topps, my favorite comeback love story, where I despised 88 Topps for so many years. And then finally, you know, a couple years ago, with the assistance of a vending box, just fell in love with it. And here's another reason why I want to take a look at 61 Topps. Great comment from Jeremiah Gardner on our timeline a few days ago. He said, aesthetics is only a small part of the charm or lack thereof in any set of sports cards, i.e. so much to love and talk about in 61 Topps. Even if the design is boring, the historical context, the innovations, the stories, 81 Topps, though, no personality or beauty. And Jeremiah touches on a couple of central themes that I have had in the previous shows about 61 Topps and 81 Topps. I have always liked 81 Topps. It is, I still think, the best of the three that came out in 1981. And you talk about storylines and historical context, especially in the line of baseball card history. you have to look at 1981. It was such a pivotal year in the collecting industry, but also in the sport, too, with the, at that time, the biggest work stoppage right in the middle of the season. And the split season and the extended playoffs sounds familiar. Yeah, we're kind of doing that all over again. But, you know, something that he brought up about aesthetics, and of course that plays a big part in the look at 1975 Tops. You know, I can understand, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, of course. And I've always liked 81 Tops, partially too, because it's from my childhood. And I, even though I wasn't collecting cards in 1981, I was only 4 years old after all, I was privy to 81 Tops at a very young age, even when I did start collecting cards several years later, because my older brother collected cards, although not quite to the extent that me or my younger brother did, but he did have a couple hundred cards from 1980 through 83, I'd say. And most of them were from the 81 and 82 top sets. So even before I thoroughly just dove into baseball cards when I was 10 or 11 years old, even when I was a little younger, say 7 or 8, if I was, you know, playing around in his bedroom playing with his toys, there was still that old lunchbox. It was a great lunchbox, too, a metal lunchbox from the NFL from, I believe, 1976 with all the team helmets on it. It was really cool. And that's where he stored his sports cards. So, you know, he had 200 or 300, mostly baseball. He had a handful of football cards, too, that were in that lunchbox. And he never really gravitated towards sports or towards sports cards like me and my younger brother did. So I kind of inherited the cards. Okay, actually, I just kind of took them from him. He didn't care. But, you know, 81 Tops has a little more of a personal attachment to me because they were always kind of in my life. And that is one of the other many hand-collated sets that slowly but surely one day will get completed. But the 61 Tops, of course, I wasn't around in 1961. They weren't as plentiful even when I was shopping for vintage cards as a teenager. I think a lot of the cards that I was able to get my hands on and afford, even if they were common cards and they were beat up, were from a time period a little later than 1961. So I typically was able to find cards from, say, 64 on up into the 70s. So, you know, I just never had the completely personal attachment to 61 Tops. But you bring up a great point, Jeremiah, in terms of the historical context. Yes, the design may lack something. And I actually discussed this in our original look at 61 Tops. One reason why the design had to be simple was simply because the expansion in 1961, and this was the first time Tops ever had to address going into the season two completely new baseball teams. Never mind teams moving from one city to another, but starting from scratch. So, you know, how did you approach the, you know, the first team, the expansion draft team in Series 1 and Series 2? Did you go out to the spring training sites of the Los Angeles Angels and the Washington Senators Part Deux and take pictures of these players for Series 3 and Series 4? How much of Series 1 and 2 would you devote to these expansion teams, knowing that chances are there were going to be plenty of player movement before the season started or in the early few weeks of the season? So, you know, Tops had a lot of issues to deal with their first run at the expansion draft. So I think that's why, and again, I alluded to this in the original episode of 61 Tops, I think that's why Tops had to keep things simple and there wasn't a whole lot of imagination to the design of the cards. And while I may call it boring, I don't call it bad. It's definitely a far cry from some of the works of art that Topps was creating throughout the 1950s. And if you consider the 53 Topps set to be the Mona Lisa of baseball card sets, and, you know, you can, you know, rank right up there 55 and 56, and, you know, 57 was a turning point in many ways. And you had kind of these Madison Avenue designs in 58 and 59, even 1960. All of a sudden, you just kind of got this plain 61 set. So I think that's why I called it boring. But again, and I remember, I mentioned this in that original podcast, it was boring, but not bad. And, you know, I think there's a big difference between the two. But what I'll do is add that to the list of show topics. We'll revisit 61 Tops, take a closer look at it. There are some legendary cards, the Mickey Mantle card, of course, the biggest there. And, of course, that was the chase of the Babe Ruth home run record between Mantle and Roger Maris. So, you know, there's a lot of storylines around it. It does deserve a second look. I never hated 61 Tops. It's not in the 90 Donruss Hall of Shame category. It's just one that I didn't really have a lot of, didn't really pay much attention to. And again, looking at just the design of the cards in the context of what led up to it and what followed it, Topps had a great string of designs for the next four or five seasons. You know, 61 Topps just kind of stands out as just kind of that set. But there are some good things about it, and we will revisit it. Now, I do want to address aesthetics, though, because even though beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and there are more things to a card set or an individual card than just aesthetics, the most important thing to remember about aesthetics is that's the first thing you notice about a card. How does it look? And, you know, we talk about beauty as in the eye of the beholder. Well, let me bring up another cliche statement here. You never have the second chance to make the first impression, or a second chance to make a first impression, which is so true in so many things in life, but especially when it comes to a product that you're marketing or selling. And in terms of baseball cards, it has to look good. And if you're not just blown off your, you know, chair looking at it the first time, then you're not going to be all that impressed with it. Now, of course, in 1961, the only card in town was Topps. And, you know, who cared about aesthetics in the sense that this was the only way that you could, you know, have little cardboard pictures of your favorite baseball players or little pieces of cardboard to jam into your bike spokes. But the aesthetics is really important, especially later on in the history of the hobby, because especially starting in 1981, you had to look good because you had to stand out from the crowd. And that's why I've always, you know, promoted 81 Topps over the Donruss and Fleer sets, because even though I like Fleer and, okay, Donruss, good job, good effort, you know, Topps had a better product aesthetically in 1981. And aesthetics is really important because if you look at anything, especially since 1981, the fates of a lot of card sets were set on aesthetics. And I think the best example is 1991 Fleer. And we've talked about the 91 Fleer set, and you can talk about some of the big rookies that are in there. There are some big name rookie cards in 91 Fleer. You can talk about some of the young superstars. There's a lot of big Hall of Fame names in that 1991 set. There's Ken Griffey Jr. There's Tom Glavine. There's John Smoltz. There's so many names from, you know, 1991 Fleer. And, you know, the 91 Fleer set had a full-color headshot on the back of the card. It had their usual plethora of statistics. It was on a pretty good card stock when some card sets were still on either gray card stock or flimsy card stock. But the banana yellow turned off so many people from the moment it was released that 91 Fleer was almost a bomb before it even left store shelves. And in the intense time of card production in 1991, where you had Upper Deck raising the bar, and you had some pretty solid designs from Topps, as I've said before, I think Bowman had a pretty good design feature. And then you have some very 1991 looking sets, such as Score and Donruss. And then, of course, the dawn of the premium sets. You had Stadium Club, you had Leaf, you know, you had Fleer Ultra. So you had a lot of sets where aesthetics was part of the bar raising. That goes to show that if you design something that doesn't look good, people aren't going to flock to it. And, you know, that's kind of been the bane of 91 Fleer for almost 30 years now. Now, of course, 91 Fleer is a big far cry from 61 Tops in the sense that there are still probably 8 gazillion copies of every card printed of 91 Fleer. You can probably buy a pack for a penny if some store owner is trying to just unload this stuff. They probably still have some cases of it in a warehouse somewhere. So, you know, it's not a perfect comparison. But I like to bring up 91 Fleer as an example of aesthetics, because when there is competition and when you do have to make that great first impression, if you flail coming out of the gate, you're going to have trouble trying to complete the race, nonetheless win it. So aesthetics is an important part of this. And even now, as the baseball card industry has, you know, kind of reverted back to a monopoly status with the exclusivity of Tops with Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association, you can still have for Tops or any of their umbrella of products, whether it's opening day or if it's Bowman or, you know, any of the other cards that come out. There's so many different lines that come out now, that if you produce something that isn't quite up to snuff in what's popular, you know, in current trends in America, then people are not going to be excited about it. Now, they'll still buy some cards just to buy them. Tops will still move the product off the shelves. But there won't be that genuine excitement if you have kind of this flat design. And I think that's certainly evident in some of the more lackluster sets that Tops produced, what, about 12, 15 years ago, and certainly into the late 90s. But of course, there was some burnout from the market back then too. So aesthetics is a key part, and we will discuss the 1961 set, maybe less focus on the aesthetics, but take a look at it in a future show. So I really do appreciate the comments there again. And lastly, before we talk about 75 Tops, we talk about aesthetics, I just want to remind you that if you would like to make a donation to Wax Ecstatic, we certainly appreciate all donations. Cash donations are appreciated via our PayPal site. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic, and Wax Ecstatic is all one word. If you have made a donation in the past, thank you very much. We've got a couple people donating $5 or $10 here and there. Every dollar goes a long way. Again, every dollar that comes to us gets brought right back into the program. So it goes to paying Audio Boom to help host the program on its website and to distribute it all across the RSS feeds that pick it up, such as Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, and others. But also it goes into the purchase of products that we discuss on this program. And in the long term, those products that we don't hang on to, the duplicates, if you will, they get packaged up into boxes and get sent off to our friends at Commons for Kids. I've had some people asking about Commons for Kids. You can find them on Twitter. Commons for Kids, all one word there. The four is a number four, by the way. So Commons, the number four, Kids. And on their Twitter profile, you'll see an address where you can mail any cards that you want them to repackage and send off to children. And it's not just baseball cards. They accept all sports, even non-sports. And also, open up your collection a little bit and find a wide array of cards. In our next shipment, we're going to be sending out a lot of fairly recent cards, too. We've had some very nice, large cardboard donations, which I'll get into in a moment. But there'll be a nice mix of cards going from, 2017 or 2018, all the way back to the mid-70s. So any cards that you have, don't just send them your junk wax. I mean, open it up a little bit. Send them some current stuff, too, because these cards are donated to kids who are just having a hard time in life. Maybe they're dealing with some financial problems at home. Maybe they're in just a bad home setting. Or maybe they're in the hospital. Maybe they're in cancer treatment centers. And they just need something to pick up their lives. And nothing is more entertaining to a young kid than a pack of baseball cards, a stack of cards, searching for their favorite player, searching for their favorite team, and just taking their mind off just the nonsense that they're dealing with. And children these days are dealing with a lot of nonsense, unfortunately. So you can make a difference with a donation to Commons for Kids. We do it often. And just remember, again, any cash donations to us and the excess product that we have, that gets packed up and they'll get shipped off to Commons for Kids. And we're going to be making a pretty big donation pretty soon. I want to say probably upwards of 3,000 cards. So I've got to find the boxes to send those in, but we'll be sending those out. And part of that Commons for Kids donation has been made through some very generous cardboard donations. Again, if you would like to donate cards either to the program or, hell, you just want to give them to me, you can just reach out to me. My email is mattsammonsez, that's all one word, mattsammonsez, @gmail.com. And just be very open and frank about what you want to donate. I want to make sure we don't have thousands of cards just dumped on my doorstep. It's happened before. I appreciate all donations, but it's kind of hard to corral them all together here. So let me know what you're thinking of donating. If it's something that we can use in an upcoming show, that's even better. Serves two purposes here, not just for cards that we collect and then perhaps send off to Commons for Kids, but it gives us some show material as well. All right, speaking of show material, let's talk about, as I have coined it, the delightfully tacky 1975 Topps set. Of course, I still may be sued by the people who run the Hooters restaurant chain, as that was their advertising slogan for a very long time. But, you know, what else can you say about 75 Topps? It is just an explosion of color. And it shouldn't come as a surprise. First of all, when you look back at some of the early 1970s Topps sets, so you had the legendary 71 Topps set, which is a work of art in so many ways. And we discussed that a few months ago when the Topps Heritage set came out for this year. But then you have 1972, which had a gaudy design. You had kind of that comic book superhero font, if you will, the Electric Company, hey, you guys, you know, kind of just like, you know, shooting letters design here when they listed the team names at the top of the card. But other than that, you know, it was a pretty basic baseball card. And then 73 and 74, great sets, but nothing too wild and crazy. They actually spent a lot of time, certainly in 1973, with action shots. They kind of rolled back the action shots in 74 because they went a little too aggressive with the action shots in the 73 set. And of course, 74, the first year that they issued the set in one series. So the design was less of a factor, and it was more just the economics behind it. Well, 1975 comes around, and there were certainly economic factors to the 75 Topps set, which we'll get to. But again, let's talk aesthetics. Wow. I mean, you can't miss a 75 Topps card. You just can't. And I think that's rather unique in that Topps always tried to design their sets for what was representative of culture at that time. And they certainly hit the nail on the head there. 1975 was peak color television time. 1975, peak time in the bright clothes, the polyesters that you would see at discotheques, and, you know, certainly the wide array of colors that you would see in bell bottoms and all sorts of unique shirts and, you know, paisley dress shirts and stuff like that. You know, there was a very conservative look to much of the early 1970s after the wild child days of the late 1960s. And by the mid 70s, things were just kind of exploding back, you know, in the other direction. And I think part of it too may have been after the morose final few years of the Nixon administration, the gas shortages, the economic troubles. This was one way that people just tried to express happiness. It was color. There was just color everywhere. And don't think that the, you know, the growth of color television doesn't have a factor in that. Color television, it was such a big factor in everything that's been done in Major League Baseball since the mid to late 1960s. And it starts with Charlie Finley's Kansas City Athletics going to the green and gold uniforms in 1963. While that was partially just to get attention and just to look different and stand out from the rest of the big leagues, kind of shake up the old boys network by not wearing the traditional white home and gray road jerseys, that was the beginning And as color television started growing in the mid to late 1960s, became more commonplace, you started seeing more color showing up in baseball, especially in uniforms, road uniforms. The Chicago White Sox, a great example. Late 1960s, they started using kind of this light blue, not quite the powder blue that we know today, but a light cobalt blue road jersey. I think the White Sox road uniforms from, I'd say, 68 to 70 are so greatly underrated. So many people don't know about them. But by the early 1970s, you had more teams wearing blue road uniforms. The Chicago Cubs, a good example as well. Of course, the Montreal Expos, they're very colorful uniforms. The A's playing up the green and gold to a hilt. The Seattle Pilots with their rather goofy blue and gold uniforms, which would transfer to the Milwaukee Brewers. And then in 1971, the Houston Astros kind of inverting their color scheme. All of a sudden, their primary color was that bright orange color. And you could see it throughout the early 70s, the White Sox switching to red and white pinstripes, the Atlanta Braves, the rather infamous, Indian feather uniform, that softball jersey that they wore in the early 1970s. And it's unique just following the history of baseball uniforms in such a short amount of time. Again, you know, really starting like 1963 with the A's, but really going full speed ahead around 1968. Where teams were, really experimenting with colors. And it's because they wanted their teams to stand out when they were on color television broadcasts. So by the early 1970s, color TV is a mainstay in the American living room. And all of a sudden, colors are just exploding off baseball uniforms everywhere. So 1975, you want to talk about exploding color. Of course, that is the year that the Astros introduced their Tequila Sunrise uniforms. Also by 1975, the San Diego Padres were wearing the all-gold road uniforms. They also had all-gold and brown home uniforms back in 1972. And, you know, the Boston Red Sox, the stodgy Boston Red Sox, even introduced their red cap in, I believe it was 1974. So even the teams that were resistant to change were suddenly changing here in this explosion of color in the mid-1970s. So it's rather appropriate that the 75 Topps set was an explosion of color. Now, it's not just for aesthetic and popularity reasons why there's a lot of color. It was also pretty cheap. If you were to take a lot of 75 Topps cards, you could lay them one end to the other and try to match colors, and you'll see another reason why Topps went with this design. As we discussed in our episode last year about the 75 Topps mini set, Topps was facing a dire economic situation in the mid-1970s. Of course, everybody was, for the reasons I just mentioned, you know, the oil crisis and the economic woes and the Nixon administration and everything just kind of crashing down in 73, 74. And, you know, Topps was looking at ways of saving money. So that is one big reason why they went to the one series set starting in 1974. That's also why they thinned out the cardboard stock starting in the mid 70s. That's another reason why they experimented with the mini set in 1975, just to see would collectors take a smaller size version of a set, even though it wasn't a carbon copy of the set, it was a smaller size and card count as well. You know, would collectors accept that rather than the usual 660 card size set? And the answer, of course, was no, and the mini set turned out to be a little bit of a novelty piece at the time. But you know, Topps is looking at ways to save money. So one easy way to save money is just kind of have this, you know, alternating color pattern on the backs of the cards that you could have as the backdrop. You have a very simple picture right in the middle. You have the player's name at the bottom of the card. You have the team name kind of similarly to the 72 Topps, where it's just this kind of raised 3D look to it. And that's it. So as bright, as colorful, as flashy as the 75 Tops set looks, when you break it down, and like I said, take if you have 20 or 30 cards from the 75 Tops set, and they don't necessarily need to be in sequential order, but take a handful of these cards and just lay them down, you know, by color, you know, right next to each other. Put the dark blue next to the dark blue. And if the top of the dark blue card has, you know, dark green, you'll find a card that's got dark green on the bottom and maybe it's got purple up top. You'll see how this is. You can kind of envision how an uncut sheet of 75 Tops would look. It's a very basic, inexpensive design when you look at it. So I think that's kind of the unique dichotomy of 75 Tops here. It's color, it's flashy, it's bright, it jumps out at you. But it's really a very basic, cost-effective design element that was baked into it. So I always thought that was kind of neat. Now, the other problems with 75 Tops, because they weren't exactly looking to spend on quality control, and this is why 75 Tops is such a royal pain in the ass to collect and to hand collate, not just because of the usual wear and tear of 45-year-old baseball cards, but also there wasn't much attention put on, like I said, quality control. So one of the biggest problems with 75 Tops is off-center cards. You've got some comically off-center cut cards. I found a few in lots that I have bought or that people have donated where it's just so off-center. I throw them out. It's just not even worth keeping because they're just so off-centered. It's ridiculous. So, you know, there's some cards that are just so ridiculously cut that it's not even worth keeping. Also, because of the 660 card layout with the 24 teams that were in Major League Baseball at the time, that also meant that you had an uneven amount of cards on some of those sheets. So you run into some short print troubles, and you also run into some double print troubles. And I have seen that before where, you know, I've received, you know, lots of 200 or 300 cards. And if it's a random lot, you know, I compare it to what I already have. And you'll see instantly, especially some of the higher numbers tend to be double prints. And it's kind of frustrating where even in a lot of 200 cards, you may have five copies of one card. And that's just because, not because of the person donating, it's simply because of just the frequency. Some of these cards were cut and put into the market so often. So it is hard to find a nice balance of the short print and the double print cards. And then, of course, you've got the cardboard conditions. Like I said, Tops was thinning out the thickness of the cardstock. That is something that would continue through the mid to late 70s. And they didn't really beef it up again until the early 80s. But, you know, that was a cost-saving measure as well. So while 75 Tops has a very unique design, and while it also has some star power, which we'll talk about in a moment, it has a lot of problems with it. And it's simply because of the economic issues at the time. Quality control was lacking, so there's off-center cut cards. A lot of ink blots, too. You have a lot of splotches on cards, the little kind of white halos that float around on some of these cards. And it's not unique to one card. It's not like there's one spot that's always in one location on one player's card. They just kind of happen everywhere. So that can be a little bit of an annoyance. And also Tops with the backs of the cards, they're a little hard to read with the dark gray cardstock. You've got this kind of reddish and pinkish back along with a dark green ink. Boy, they loved green back then. So even though it wasn't the primary color, it was used in some of the prints. And it's a little difficult to read. So as much love as there is for 75 Tops because of some of the star power in the rookie cards, there's a lot of headaches with it as well. And it's, again, because Tops just had to cut corners in 1975. Experimenting with the mini set, reducing the thickness of the card stock, not really paying much attention to some of the ink issues or the cutting issues. And again, with the short prints and double prints, just because of how the cards were laid out in a 660 card set. Now, with that said, 75 Tops is a fun one to try to track down. As long as you, from the get-go, you say, all right, I'm not going to have a mint set. And that is what I came to when I decided that I was going to try to build out the 75 top set. I said, okay, Matt, you're just not going to have a near mint set. So, you know, some cards have some creases and some rounded corners and some wax stains, and And that's okay. You know, if I buy a lot of cards and I find one that's in slightly better condition, then I'll swap it out. But any hopes of finding, anything close to, you know, like what we found in this pack that Casey sent us, it's very, very difficult to find that. So I think as you, open yourself up to the idea of, okay, this set may not be in near mint condition, then you at least allow yourself a little bit of sanity and just collecting the cards and not necessarily trying to find those PSA 10s out there. And one thing that helped me was one of those big rookie cards, a Robin Yount card. I bought at a local card shop. It was pretty beat up, but I bought it for like $12 or whatever. So even though the corners are not perfect and there's a slight little crease there, I have no trouble taking Robin Yount's rookie card and just putting it in a box with, you know, what will soon be 659 other cards. So, you know, when it came to the George Brett card, which I still have not procured, but I'm still shopping, you know, I'll just look for any condition George Brett card. And still, even a PSA 2 goes for $25 or $30, which is kind of mind-blowing, but that's just how it is. But that just goes to show you just the incredible rookie card power that 75 Tops has. Brett and Yount are the most powerful cards that are in that set. But there are some other notable rookie cards. Of course, Gary Carter, I would say probably number three, coming in very close behind teammates Jim Rice and Fred Lynn of the Boston Red Sox. So you've got a lot of rookie card power. You've got some incredible young stars, including Mike Schmidt. Also, you've got, Carlton Fisk is in there as well. You've got many of the stars from the late 1960s, Tom Seaver, Pete Rose, Gaylord Perry. I mean, anybody who was anybody in the game is featured in that set. And you also have some late career cards, I should mention, including players like Joe Torre. Also, Frank Robinson. Remember, 1975, he became the first African-American manager of a baseball team. He was still a player manager for the Cleveland Indians. So you can get some late career cards of some outstanding players. Brooks Robinson, for example. Henry Aaron, of course. And there was quite the tribute to Hank Aaron in 1974, as he has card number one in the 74 highlights, but also card number 660 is his regular card. And by then, the Atlanta Braves had just dispensed him to the Milwaukee Brewers, but it was a nice way for Topps to kind of showcase what Hank Aaron had done in 1974. He is literally bookending the 1975 top set. So it's loaded with rookies, it's loaded with stars, it's loaded with color, as was everything in 1975, but it is loaded with some speed bumps. Like I said, bad cuts, bad color mixes, bad printing errors, and a whole lot of double prints that will frustrate you. But if you go in with the notion of, I'm just going to collect this set, I don't care what condition they're in, I just want all 660 of them in one box or one binder, then you'll find yourself in a pretty good position to where you're not driving yourself crazy trying to find near mint condition cards from, you know, pack after pack or set after set or lot after lot. So just kind of keep that in mind if you collect 75 tops. This is an ambitious project for me. Like I said, it's the oldest set that I've been trying to collect. I've mostly focused on, you know, junk wax era sets because they're from my childhood and they're a lot easier to pull together. But thanks to, you know, whether it's some cardboard donations or, you know, I had purchased some vending boxes from the early to mid 80s, my card collecting or set completion focus, I guess I should say, has shifted from, say, 87 to 92. Backwards to 75 to 86. So I'm closing in on 86. I'm getting closer on 84. I'm feeling pretty good that not too far from now I'll have 77, but 75, that's an endeavor, but it's going to be fun and it will certainly be colorful. All right, let's take a look at some of the colorful personalities from the 75 Tops pack that we have. Like I said, 10 cards in the pack, but 9 of them were player cards, so we'll quickly go through those 9 players. And there were some interesting stories with some of these players. And the first player card that we pulled was Bobby Valentine, which allows me to share my story once again of meeting Bobby Valentine when he was the manager of the Texas Rangers. And, you know, we were part of a Boy Scout troop that was there doing a color guard ceremony at spring training. And this would have been 1991. That's right. That was the first year we did it. And that was Valentine's last year as the manager, I believe. And he was in this players and family section that we were in. And I think there was some concern that some of the scouts were bugging some of the players that weren't dressed for the game because, of course, you know, we're all teenagers with baseball cards. We're trying to get autographs. So Bobby Valentine, who has this very unique voice, kind of this ballsy Kermit the Frog, if you will.
Oh, hello, boys. How are you doing today? Sure, I'll sign your card, but you make sure that you're not interfering with any of the players or their families, okay?
But Bobby Valentine was always nice. I remember that. He was always nice. He was energetic and certainly had a personality, and that was certainly one thing that he was known for when he was playing in the Dodgers organization in the early 70s. But he was a player who stood out from a very early age growing up in Connecticut, playing predominantly baseball, but he was also a running back in football for a couple of years. In high school, he was such a good two-sport star that he was scouted heavily by Southern California. And in fact, the story goes, USC's head coach John McKay, the legendary John McKay, what did you think about your team's execution? I'm in favor of it. Yes, that John McKay reportedly was so impressed with Valentine's skill set as a football player that he essentially promised that he would replace O.J. Simpson, and Valentine was good enough to win the Heisman Trophy. Now, of course, some of this may be smoke up Valentine's backside here because it is recruiting, but, you know, I don't think John McKay would say that to pretty much anybody. Of course, it wasn't just USC that was getting all the attention throwing at Bobby Valentine here. You had the Cape Cod League that was looking very closely at Valentine as a baseball player. And also while visiting USC, he was, let's just say, rather somewhat illegally recruited by a soon-to-be legend in Dodger blue, Tommy Lasorda. And as the story is told through our good friends at the Saber Project, Thomas J. Brown Jr., with this story here, while Valentine is being courted by USC, basically, Tom Lasorda sits down next to Bobby Valentine and says, "Don't look at me. I'm not talking to you. I'm not supposed to be talking to you, but I know who you are. I want you to know we really like what you're doing." And according to the story, this mysterious person sucking down Slim Fast shakes next to him hands him a transistor radio, and on it was the Dodger logo. And inside the transistor radio was Tommy Lasorda's business card. At the time, Lasorda was a scout for the Dodgers, of course, would later become the manager. So, Tom Lasorda kind of working his magic to, you know, kind of get Valentine in the Dodgers spotlight. And what do you know? The Dodgers do draft him as the fifth overall pick in the first round of the 1968 June amateur draft, part of a very impressive young group. We were talking in the last program about Ron Say, how Say was a big part of an infield that included Davey Lopes and Steve Garvey, Bill Buckner, this group that played together in throughout much of the 1970s in the Dodgers organization. Well, Valentine was part of that mix, and he could play anywhere. He was very speedy. He had a decent bat, very energetic personality as well. And he moved up through the Dodger farm system, finally got a cup of coffee at the end of the 1970 season, and also got to play quite a bit more in 1971, over 101 games. The ultimate utility player. Shortstop, second base, outfielder, also a little bit of time at third base as well. And his game gradually improved. He seemed to be part of this young collection of future stars in the Dodgers in the 1972 season. But again, when you look at the other guys that were around him, you've got Say, you've got Lopes, you've got Garvey, you've got Buckner. You know, there's just no room for a guy like Bobby Valentine. Yeah, he's full of potential, and you can plug him in anywhere. But the Dodgers were pretty stacked at that time, as they would start making many of their National League pennant appearances starting in 1974. Well, before we got to that point, in the 1972 winter, in fact, November of 72, Valentine would get traded to the California Angels along with Billy Grabarkiewicz, Frank Robinson, Bill Singer, and Mike Strahler. And the Dodgers, in return, get Ken McMullen and Andy Messersmith. Now, at first, Bobby Valentine had a pretty good start in the American League, hitting .302 in 1973. However, he suffered a gruesome and life-altering ankle injury in a collision early in the 1973 season. It was a double compound fracture that permanently altered the way that his right ankle was for the rest of his life. Like, his ankle was basically set backwards in the bone structure, and he was just never quite the same player since then. He would miss the remainder of the 73 season, was able to play for a little bit in 1974, also again as a utility player, but again because of the ankle injury, just totally robbed him of his speed, and his career as a player went down from there. He would split time between the major leagues and minor leagues in 1975. Eventually, in September of 75, getting traded along with 75 Topps legend Rudy Mioli to the San Diego Padres for Gary Ross. So he is again splitting time between the major leagues and minor leagues in 1976 with the Padres organization. In June of 1977, he's part of the Mets Midnight Massacre as he was shipped along with Paul Seabert to the Mets for Dave Kingman. Kingman going to the Padres there. That was also where Tom Seaver, of course, going to the Cincinnati Reds. Mike Phillips going to the St. Louis Cardinals, who that rather infamous night in June. Bobby Valentine was part of it. Of course, he'd be part of some more infamous moments in Mets history later on. But at that point in time as a player, that was one of his most infamous moments there. He would play for the Mets through spring training 1979 when he was released. He would then sign on as a member of the Seattle Mariners. And after the 79 season, he would be released as a player. Now, he would get into coaching. In fact, he would be a coach in the Mets organization for several years afterwards. Became the manager of the Texas Rangers in 1985 after Doug Rader, who was another player in this card pack. So we'll talk about the Red Rooster in a little bit. But Doug Rader was fired. Bobby Valentine comes in. He was the youngest manager of the major leagues at the time. When he came in 1985, the Rangers were 9-23. At the end of the season, they would finish 62-99. But he was able to rally the Rangers to their best season yet. They would finish right behind the California Angels in the 1986 playoff run, as they finished, I believe, just a game behind the Angels. They were right behind them. I know they finished 87-75, but it was since Billy Martin's appearance as a manager in Texas in 1974, it was one of the quickest turnarounds in Texas Rangers history from a laughingstock team into a contender. Unfortunately for Valentine, even though the Rangers improved in 1986, they were never able to get over the top. They never had that great mix of players. You had some young talent, some good batters. Over the years, they would add, you know, Juan Gonzalez and Ivan Rodriguez and Ruben Sierra. Julio Franco would play a little bit of time there. And of course, Nolan Ryan would eventually come into the pitching rotation. But the Rangers, while they were a good team, they never ascended to greatness. And for Valentine, halfway through the 1992 season, he was fired. Even though the Rangers were 45-41 at that time, the owner of the Rangers, George W. Bush, did not like how they were 6.5 games out and not playing well. So they decided to make a change. So Valentine leaves the Texas Rangers. He would go on to Cincinnati as a member of the Reds coaching staff in 1993. And then he would make a rather interesting choice. He would go over to Japan to manage a team there for a couple of years. And while he was able to kind of revive his career as a manager, who comes calling looking for a new manager? That would be the New York Mets in 1996 after Dallas Green had the Mets off to a rather funky start. Here comes Bobby Valentine, and as the Mets were rebuilding in 96 and 97, he seemed to have that magic touch. Not quite the quickest of turnarounds with the Texas Rangers, but with the Mets eventually acquiring Mike Piazza and also several other players, they were able to turn into a contending team for several years afterwards, of course, appearing in the 2000 World Series and getting booted aside in that series by the New York Yankees. Now, that moment of greatness in 2000, despite getting swept by the Yankees in the World Series, the Mets were still a contending team until the bottom fell out in 2002 and after the season, Valentine was released. He would then go back to the Japanese League and coach there for several years, and he would again get a second chance at coaching in the big leagues with the Boston Red Sox, as he was named their manager in 2012, and rather infamously was pushed out very quickly after the 2012 season. He was not popular. He didn't mesh well with some of the young, brash personalities that the Red Sox had at that time. Notably, David Ortiz was very much against Bobby Valentine, and vice versa. And after that, his time as a major league manager ended. He is now the athletic director at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. He's been there since 2013. I should also mention, and many people know this, Bobby Valentine, of course, a member of ESPN's baseball coverage in the 2009-2010, so about 10 years ago. So that is a look at Bobby Valentine, one of the more colorful characters in this colorful set, but not quite as colorful as our next player, a player who was a good but certainly not great player, well known in every ballpark they played for because of his personality, talking about John Lowenstein. John Lowenstein was selected by the Cleveland Indians in the 18th round of the June 1968 draft. Now, like many youngsters at this time, he had to fulfill some military obligations. So he was on Marine Reserve units in the late 1960s and was still kind of keeping his toe in the baseball waters in the minor leagues. Now, his manager with the Wichita Arrows at the time, the AAA farm club of the Cleveland Indians, Ken Aspromonte, really liked John Lowenstein. So later on, when Aspromonte becomes the manager of the Cleveland Indians, Lowenstein would find his way fast-tracked to Cleveland after getting cups of coffee in 1970 and 1971. So when Aspro becomes the manager in 1972, Lowenstein finds his way fast-tracked to Cleveland, where, much like Bobby Valentine, he was very much a utility player. He could fit in anywhere, often in the outfield, but could be plugged into infield positions as well. He was a stolen base leader for the Indians in 1974 with 36, and he also was a fairly decent batter who was averaging around 240, 250. But he, again, it was his personality that won people over, his very unique thoughts about the world, including the fan clubs. You know, you had individual player fan clubs at that time. Well, there wasn't going to be a John Lowenstein fan club, so he kind of took some fun with it by creating the Lowenstein Apathy Club. So there were a lot of Cleveland fans. Of course, you have to think about how much apathy there was for the Cleveland Indians back in the mid-70s. A lot of fans had some fun with it, and they sent in letters of support, or lack of support, I should say. They sent in letters jokingly saying, "We don't care about John Lowenstein." So you had the Lowenstein Apathy Club, which he took with full-throated vigor, too. He absolutely loved being part of that inside joke with Indians fans. Now, Lowenstein was part of one of the most interesting trades in baseball history, and it all centers around the 77 expansion draft. The Indians inadvertently left Mr. Big Bat, Rico Carty, exposed in the expansion draft. Well, Toronto picks up Carty as one of the selections, so the Indians decided to get Carty back by shipping Lowenstein and catcher Rick Cerrone to Toronto. Now, just a couple of days later, Cleveland would pick up Johnny Grubb, Hector Torres, and Fred Kendall in a deal with the San Diego Padres for George Hendrick. So Grubb comes up with a strained knee injury in spring training. So the Indians then send Hector Torres to Toronto to get John Lowenstein. So Lowenstein was very briefly a member of the Toronto Blue Jays, but never played for them in a regular season game. And Lowenstein considered it a United Nations trade, which was rather interesting. Also, I found this note hilarious, too. Despite the name Lowenstein, he is not of Jewish heritage. So even though the organist at Municipal Stadium would often play Hava Nagila when he came to bat, he notified the organist, "Hey, I'm not Jewish, I'm Roman Catholic." So then the theme song for his at-bats changed to Jesus Christ Superstar. So that's what we would call in the DJ industry musical whiplash. We're kind of going from one form to another here. So after the 1977 season, he gets traded along with Tom Buskey to the Texas Rangers for Willie Horton and the busted arm of David Clybe. He would play with the Rangers in 1978, again being a utility player. Then picked up off waivers by the Baltimore Orioles, and that would be a key acquisition to the Orioles as he played a key cog in their 1979 American League championship run. And he also played a very key part in the Orioles World Series championship in 1983. Now, he would get released by the Orioles in 1985, his 16-year career in the major leagues done. Certainly quite a career as a utility player and a very unique person and personality. After his playing days, he would move into the broadcast booth. He was part of the Orioles TV crew with the home team sports network, pushed out of the booth in 1996. And he and his wife would live in Las Vegas up until her unfortunate death in 2005. So there you go. Another colorful personality from a colorful set in John Lowenstein. Now, not a whole lot of information about this next card. Vic Alberi, who is a pitcher very briefly with the Minnesota Twins, who sadly passed away from a heart attack in Tampa, Florida, actually just a few years ago, back in 2017. Vic Alberi was one of those players who was drafted by the Indians in 1965, a ninth round draft selection, yet he never played for the Indians in the big leagues, and he's part of a mystery transaction. I've looked everywhere for details about this transaction in 1969, and there's just really no definitive record of it. And in fact, if you look at baseballreference.com, the transaction is listed, and I quote, "Before 1969 season, sent from the Cleveland Indians to the San Diego Padres in an unknown transaction." So somehow Vic Alberi, a member of the Indians minor league organization, just ends up in San Diego somehow. I'm sure it was the Padres just needing to fill a roster position, and the Indians were like, "Yeah, we're not going to use this guy." So they just probably dumped him for cash. Of course, the Indians are notorious for looking for money in any way possible. Now, he would never play for the Padres either. He was drafted by the Twins from the Padres in the 1970 minor league draft in November of 1970. Finally, in 1973, making his major league debut at the age of 26. Had a good brief appearance with the Twins in 1973, appearing in 14 games, 2.70 earned run average. But after that, it was all downhill. He had a lot of control problems, too. Always had more balls than strikes. Certainly shows up in his career numbers. And the Twins were not a very good team in the mid-1970s, a very cheap operation as well. So in total, his major league career would run over 4 years. He appeared in 101 games, starting 37 of them, and finishing with a 4.11 earned run average. And I know he faced a lot of injuries and a lot of ineffectiveness, and that's about it. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot more information on the late Vic Alberi. Now, one of the other cards, Mike Hegan, the son of Jim Hegan, the mainstay behind the plate in Cleveland throughout the late 1940s and 1950s. Mike Hegan, a much beloved player, first with the New York Yankees, as he would serve two terms with the Yankees and later two terms with the Milwaukee Brewers. A very interesting little tidbit to his career here, as he was signed by the Yankees in August of 1961. Reportedly, he was offered contracts by 15 major leagues, but he signed with the Yankees, even though a couple other teams offered more money. Of course, there's, you know, the aura of playing for the Yankees, but also as a left-handed hitter, he was obviously drawn to the right field porch at Old Yankee Stadium. Now, as he's moving his way up through the minor league system, he would actually get a cup of coffee in September of 1964, made his major league debut September 13th, 1964, but would spend much of the next 2 years back in AAA, eventually getting called back up in September of 1966, gets his first major league hit September 15th of 66. Also having to deal with military requirements and duties in the 1967 season, so he's splitting time between the major leagues and doing some reserve work. But he's also finding himself really just struggling with the Yankees, even though the Yankees had, you know, that right field porch, which was heaven for a left-handed hitter. They also had a logjam at first base. You had Moose Scourin, you had Andy Kosko, you had Joe Pepitone. And also by this time in 1968, as Mickey Mantle's career is winding down, the Yankees have him playing at first base. Of course, this is before the designated hitter, so you pretty much moved all of your retiring, aging players to first base just to keep them in the lineup. So Hagan was back and forth between New York and the Yankees AAA Farm Club in Syracuse, and he finally gets a break in June of 1968 when the Yankees sold his rights to the expansion Seattle Pilots for $25,000. Now, there was part of the deal here where Hagan couldn't, just be sitting in a Pilots farm club. The Pilots said, all right, you've got to keep him in Syracuse. So that's what he did. So he was a member of the Yankees AAA team, but technically, legally, a member of the Seattle Pilots. Now, he would be the first player to sign with the Pilots in 1969. He was enjoying the thrill of being able to go play ball on a regular basis. He would platoon a little bit with Don Mincher, but he was perfectly fine in Seattle. And, of course, they had plenty of former Yankees around him, too, so he was able to fit in real well. But as we know, the Seattle Pilots flailed and then eventually moved on to Milwaukee in 1970. And he would succeed in Milwaukee as well. In fact, he started 178 consecutive games at first base without making an error. That started in September of 1970, a streak that would run into 1973. By then, a member of the Oakland Athletics. In fact, he was sold to the A's in 1971, was part of their World Series team in 1972, and was starting in Oakland in 1973. But again, got squeezed out by some more talented players, and in August of 1973, he was purchased by the New York Yankees. Of course, the Yankees are rebuilding at this time, but Hagan would put his name in the record books as he would become the final batter in the old Yankee Stadium, the pre-renovation Yankee Stadium, as he flied out to center field in an 8-5 loss to the Detroit Tigers. Now, he would platoon first base with Bill Sudeikis, later Chris Chambliss, in 1974, and he was kind of moving around a little bit with the Yankees organization, too, as they were trying to find a spot for him. Finally, the Yankees decided to answer a trade request from Hagan, where they sent him to Milwaukee. So Hagan was part of the Brewers in 1975 and 1976. He also has the status of being one of the few players. In fact, he was at that time just the sixth player to ever pinch hit for Hank Aaron. Happened July 8th of 1975. By 1977, his career is starting to wind down. He's unhappy with how things are going in Milwaukee, and the Brewers release him midway through the 1977 season. Now, he would move on to the broadcasting booth as well, much like John Lowenstein, providing color commentary for the Brewers TV games for the next 11 years. He would also operate a hitting camp in suburban Milwaukee and would eventually move on to Cleveland to join the broadcasting group there as well in the early 1990s. He retired from broadcasting in 2011, passed away on Christmas Day 2013, sadly, of heart problems, leaving behind a wife and two boys and four grandchildren. Now we move on to a familiar name. Like I said, we may have discussed this gentleman before, so we'll be brief here. Baylor Moore, the next card in the pack. And Baylor Moore has the notoriety of being the first amateur entry selection, amateur entry draft selection, for the Montreal Expos. He was chosen in the first round, 22nd overall, in 1969. He had a lot of promise, a lot of potential, and we all know what potential can be. It's a dirty word until you actually turn potential into reality, and that was sadly much of Baylor Moore's career, especially with the Expos. After he had some very promising streaks in the Expos minor league system, he would eventually make his major league debut in 1970. As he made his debut at the age of 19 in May of 1970, he faced one batter, Willie Stargell. Welcome to the big leagues, kid. He was able to get Stargell to line out, however. That was pretty much the only highlight of the season, as he pitched a whopping 9 2/3 innings with a 7.45 earned run average. He was consistently going back and forth between Montreal and the farm system, and struggled not only just with pitching in general, but also with injuries too. He also has a rather dubious footnote in major league history, as he is the pitcher who surrendered Mike Schmidt's first major league home run back on September 16th, 1972. Again, dealing with injury issues and just not living up to expectations. He would later picked up by the California Angels in 1975, the Expos selling his contract then. Again, going back and forth between AAA and the major leagues with the Angels, and eventually getting sold once again to the Toronto Blue Jays, who were just looking for any warm bodies and arms at this early stage of their time. He would go on to pitch for three seasons with the Blue Jays, eventually retiring after the 1981 season, following some brief minor league operations in the Brewers and Astros system. So there's the brief history of Baylor Moore, again, a guy who had lots of promise but was never able to fully live up to that. Now, another player who had lots of promise and for the most part lived up to it, but also lived under the shadows of some pretty terrible baseball teams, was Loron Lee. But Lee would actually leave a rather interesting impression on the game of baseball. Now, Lee started up with the St. Louis Cardinals in the late 1960s. He was a first-round selection, seventh overall in the 1966 draft out of Grant Union High School in Sacramento, very quickly working his way up through the Cardinals system, and in 1970 became a mainstay for the Cardinals, as he played mostly in the outfield, in left field in particular. He would appear in 121 games in 1970, but only hitting .227, not quite living up to expectations. His batting average would rise, however, in 1971, but that was after splitting time between St. Louis and San Diego, a deal that had him, along with Fred Norman, going to the young Padres in June of 71 for Al Santorini. He had a pretty productive 1970 season, appearing in 121 games and hitting his first major league home run off of Ferguson Jenkins. Not so bad. Still only a .227 batting average in 1970, not quite living up to some of the hyped up expectations of being a first round draft selection. So midway through the 71 season, he's traded to the San Diego Padres, where he would become an early star, as he was able to have some multi-home run games. And also some gems out in the outfield as well. Notably broke up a no-hitter attempt by Tom Seaver in 1972, as Lee would single with one out in the ninth inning. And after three seasons in San Diego, he was purchased by the Cleveland Indians, where he had several multi-hit games and also hit a grand slam and a solo home run to account for all five runs in the Indians' 5-2 victory over Kansas City. Now, he would sign as a free agent with the Dodgers in 1975, but again, a lot of talent there in front of him. So even though he had some moments in the sun, just wasn't able to break through with that very talented Dodgers team. So he made a very controversial decision to go play in Japan. Now, in the late 1970s, if you played in Japan, it's because your career was done. That was not the case for Loron Lee. He was actually in the prime of his career. He wasn't playing for a bad team. He wasn't playing for a good team where there were talented people in front of him. He finally got a chance to be a consistent player with the Lotte Orions, and he would actually play with the Orions for 11 seasons. Up until the 2000 season, he held the Japanese League record for career batting average, and he also led the league in home runs and runs batted in 1977. Won the batting title in 1980 as well. So he really set the trend where the Japanese League wasn't a place where your career died. It could be revived. Of course, we talked about how Bobby Valentine was able to revive his managing career there a couple times. But as a player, this was kind of a strange idea in the 1970s. But it would open the door for other players later on. I think Cecil Fielder is probably the best example, a guy who was, you know, kind of lost in the shuffle with a talented Toronto team in the mid-80s. Finally got some time to play overseas by himself, and then would later star with the Detroit Tigers, among some other teams. So after his career, which wrapped up in 1987 in Japan, he would become the batting coach for the Oakland Athletics, part of their 1989 World Series championship team, and he is currently a roving hitting instructor for the Cincinnati Reds organization. So we had the connection between LaRon Lee and Bobby Valentine in terms of reviving one's career in Japan. Well, here's the other tie-in to Bobby Valentine. It's kind of ironic. It's all in one pack of cards here. The Red Rooster, old Rojo, Dave Rader, longtime third baseman, mostly with the Houston Astros, a guy who was not known for his bat. In fact, he was a very light-hitting third baseman. I say light-hitting in the sense that he averaged around 250 for much of his career. He did have some power, but what really saved him, especially in the early days with the Houston Astros, was his defense. He was originally a first baseman for the Astros, but then got moved over to third base in the late 1960s, and that would prove very well for him and for the team, as he was a five-time Gold Glove winner at the hot corner starting in 1970. And when I say five times, I mean five consecutive Gold Gloves from 1970 to 1975. Now, he originally started with the Astros and as an amateur free agent in 1965. Like I said, went from first base to third base starting in 1968, and that would pay off rather well for him. But the good glove work can only help you only so much, as finally the Astros, looking for an offensive upgrade at third base by the mid-1970s, decided to trade Rader to the San Diego Padres in December of 1975 for Larry Hardy and Joe McIntosh. Now, the Padres were looking for a veteran third baseman, and he would serve that role rather well, hitting 257, power numbers down, but again, a pretty solid defensive effort at third base in 1976 and 1977. Now, the Toronto Blue Jays would pick up Rader's contract in June of 1977, so he split time at third base and as the designated hitter in 96 games, hitting 240 with 13 home runs. And midway through spring training in 1978, he would get released by the Blue Jays, and that would basically end his career as a player. Now, he would, much like Bobby Valentine, get into coaching, working first with the Padres organization in San Diego in 79, and then later the manager of their AAA affiliate in Hawaii from 1980 to 82. He was hired to manage the Texas Rangers heading into the 1983 season, and as mentioned before, after a 9-23 start in 1985, replaced by Bobby Valentine. He was an interim manager for the White Sox after Tony La Russa was dismissed in 1986, and later became the permanent manager for the California Angels in 1989, where he helped guide the Angels to a 91-71 record in 89. Of course, not good enough to catch the A's in the American League West, but a pretty good turnaround for the Angels coming off of a 75-87 record in 1988, and he actually finished fourth in American League Manager of the Year award voting back then. The Angels, however, would slip to 80-82 in 1990, and then in 1991, the bottom dropping out 61-63. That was enough for the Angels to replace Doug Rader with Buck Rogers. And then he would wrap up his coaching career with the expansion Florida Marlins as their first hitting coach in the 1993 in 94 seasons. Now, one of the more mysterious players from this pack of cards, and not just because he has this rather ho-hum card here. a guy who was clearly on the move because Topps wanted to use the picture of him without his cap on, just sporting the cowlick hair design here, is Bruce Ellingson. So not Duke Ellington, Bruce Ellingson, who was a left-handed pitcher who only appeared in 16 games in the major leagues, and in fact only started two games, all with the Cleveland Indians in 1974. So as he's pictured here in 1975, he's not even doing anything in the big leagues at this time, and he had to deal with a lot of injury issues as well. Originally drafted by the Dodgers in 1967, he would play six full seasons in the Dodgers farm systems before getting traded to the Indians in April 1974. This was a deal that at the time seemed to make sense, but in the end would prove to be incredibly lopsided. As the Indians, just looking for arms, they acquire Ellingson from the Dodgers for some 17-year-old rookie league guy named Pedro Guerrero. That didn't work out too well. Guerrero, of course, 15 years in the big leagues, a big part of the Dodgers 81 World Series championship. Bruce Ellingson then long gone out of baseball, as he would start the 74 season in AAA, would appear in a Cleveland Indians uniform starting in July, was a starting pitcher in September for a couple of starts in 1974, and yeah, that was pretty much it. He would return to minor league baseball in 1975 and retired from the big leagues shortly afterwards. So Bruce Ellingson, not a whole lot of history in terms of what he did on the diamond, but best known for who he was traded for. Yes, he was the guy that the Indians gave up Pedro Guerrero for. And again, Pedro had a pretty productive career, I would have to say. Last but not least, slight wax stain on the back of the car, but that's okay. Don Hahn here, seen with the New York Mets. And the funny thing here is Don Hahn was not playing for the Mets at the time. In fact, he was facing a rather bizarre final season in his major league career in 1975, but pictured here with the Mets. So Don Hahn was better known for his glove than his bat, much like Doug Rader. He had a career a batting average of .236, but he was able to craft a pretty good, 6 or 7 year season with the big leagues, was also part of some Montreal Expos firsts and part of the 73 National League champion New York Mets. He came out of Campbell High School of Campbell, California, three sport star, baseball, football, and basketball. And he was originally drafted by the San Francisco Giants in the 17th round of the 1966 draft. Now, he was part of the Montreal Expos inaugural team on April 8th, 1969. He was the starting center fielder as the Expos visited the Mets at Shea Stadium. And in the history books, he is noted as the first player to field a ball for the Expos, as Tommy Agee has a single to center field, so he picks up the ball and throws it into the infield, and that is that. The Expos would go on to defeat the Mets 11-10, and he would also go 0-3 in his first major league game. Now, in 1971, he is traded to the Mets for Ron Swoboda and minor leaguer Rich Hacker. So he would become the starting center fielder for the Mets by 1973. He was also part of all 12 postseason games for the 73 season, which is actually quite amazing considering that Don Hahn was involved in a very major collision in the outfield along with teammate George Theodore. Theodore actually dislocated his hip when the two crashed into each other chasing a fly ball. But Hahn was able to escape with the least injuries and was part of that amazing Mets team of 1973. Now, after the 74 season, which he did spend with the Mets, he went to the Philadelphia Phillies in a deal that was the first of many. Don Hahn would change addresses quite a few times in 1975. So follow the bouncing ball here. As December 3rd, 1974, Hahn, along with Tug McGraw and Dave Schneck traded to the Phillies for Max Scherz, John Stearns, and Dell Unser. Now, of course, McGraw would play a big part of the Phillies rebuild and be part of the 1980 World Series championship. Not so lucky for Hahn. He's released by the Phillies in May of 1975. That same day, signs as a free agent with the St. Louis Cardinals, but only lasts with the Cardinals organization for just a few weeks, as he was eventually purchased by the San Diego Padres in June of 1975, and that would be how his career ended. Now, he did get some playing time with all three teams. He appeared in 9 games with the Phillies, 7 games with the Cardinals, and 34 games with the Padres before he hung it up. So there it is, Don Hahn, noted for some historical moments in Montreal Expos history, but playing a small role in the New York Mets' success in 1973. But much like his 1975 season, just kind of all over the place, which is much like the design of the 1975 Topps set. Yes, colorful, but riddled with issues because Topps was trying to save some money, but still fun to collect as long as you don't get too concerned about the condition of the cards. If you're okay with the less than PSA 10 cards that you're going to find in many of these 75 Topps packs, then you'll be okay. You'll be able to collect the set and be proud of it. Now, the 75 set, again, is relatively affordable if you're looking for just cards of any conditions, if you're not too concerned about PSA 10-ness, if you will. But if you're looking for anything of great condition, you're going to be searching for a long time simply because of all those issues that we talked about, the off-center cuts, the ink splotches, the double prints, the short prints, and chasing those rookie cards, most notably Yount and Brett, but also Carter, Rice, Lynn. Plus, you've got some of those big early career cards of Schmidt and Fisk and you name it. There's a lot of big names there. But the color, the names, the rookies, the age of the cards, you know, it's kind of hard to track some of these down as opposed to more recent sets. It makes it a pretty fun and sometimes frustrating set to build. But if you go into it with the notion of having some fun and just collecting cards, not because of condition or value, but because it's a neat 660-card set and very representative of the game, of the colors of the time, and the economics of the time, then you will certainly enjoy 75 Topps. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this program as we went through essentially a pack of 75 Topps cards, some colorful stories from a colorful set. Join us for our next program. What are we going to talk about? I have no idea. We're both going to find out together. The next program coming your way via Audio Boom and all of our channels on Friday, August the 14th. Until then, share your comments, your thoughts, your suggestions at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. You can make cash donations to the program at paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you would like to make a cardboard donation, again, email me, mattsalmonsez, that's S-E-Z, @gmail.com. And until next time, wash your hands, wear your mask, practice social distancing. Please, let's try to get this coronavirus beaten down, and we can do that together. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We'll see you next time on Wax Ecstatic.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.